We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, a story of Irish immigration in the latter half of the 20th century. Writer Mary Beth Keane is our guest. Her debut novel, The Walking People, begins with a prologue set in New York City. The year is 2007. Keane's story then leads readers across the Atlantic to the west of Ireland and to two families, the Cahills and the Wards. The year is 1956. The Cahills are country people. They make their way by farming and by poaching salmon. The Wards are travelers. They are alternately known as wanderers, tinkers, thieves. But Michael Ward, who has spent 37 years toiling beneath the streets of New York, realized as a young immigrant that all those who have made the journey from Ireland to the U.S. are travelers. In this portion of the program, we'll hear more about Michael Ward, his love, Greta Cahill, their families and their lives in America and Ireland. We'll talk about the immigrant experience, what life was like for people like the Cahills and the Wards in the impoverished west of Ireland in the 1950s, what it's like to leave, and what it's like to find oneself and make one's way in a foreign land. Mary Beth Keane was honored with the Chicago Tribune's Nelson Algren Award in 2004. In 2005, she was nominated for a Pushcart Prize. Her first novel, The Walking People, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Mary Beth Keane, good to talk with you. How are you?
Thank you. I'm very good. Thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. Well, you are the daughter of Irish immigrants. When and how did your parents come to the U.S.?
They came in 1963 and 1964. They came by plane, unlike these characters, to New York, and they both came to their older siblings who'd been here for a couple of years.
Hmm. In what part of Ireland did they come from?
My dad is from Connemara in Galway, and my mother is from Mayo, so both out the west, as they say.
Yeah. And why did they leave?
My father left for economic reasons, like a lot of people. There really wasn't any work there for him, and a lot of people in his village and his area had left. My mother left for similar reasons. There were jobs that she may have been able to get at home, but there were more jobs here. She actually did a lot of back and forth. She kept changing her mind, and she'd come to New York and say, this is for good, and then she'd go home and say, this is for good, and went back and forth a bit, but she finally stayed.
Yeah. Boy, she's a traveler.
Yeah.
So where is home? When you say the word home in your home, what does it mean?
In my home growing up, it definitely meant Mayo and Galway, specifically. And also to the exclusion of other parts of Ireland. I wasn't in Dublin till I was an adult and went by myself. So whenever we went there, we went to those places and stayed. And so I didn't really see a lot of Ireland, even though I'd been there many times, until I kind of did some traveling of my own over there, which is typical, I think.
Yeah.
We did a little farming, learned how to turn hay, things like that. So,
Have you drawn on the stories of your parents and their siblings for The Walking People?
To some extent, this is... What actually happens to these characters isn't entirely fiction, but, I mean, the idea of leaving home and trying to make your way somewhere else is certainly brought from home. And I should say my entire town where I grew up is predominantly Irish, first generation. So it was all around me all the time. And I definitely thought about that a lot and all they'd gone through to get here, to get from A to B, and how different their lives must be now. And to have been in a single place for so many generations and then to be the first person to uproot and start this different course, definitely, like, that all inspired the themes in the book.
Yeah.
But
I found myself time and time again as I'm reading The Walking People thinking of what it is like to leave essentially a rural place and land in New York City.
Yeah. It's shocking. I know my dad, when he came to JFK Airport, which then was Idlewild Airport, thought, you know, well, that's it, because I will never find my way back. you know, all those roads intersecting each other, and they're up and down, and there's highways above you and below you. And I can just imagine, if I'm intimidated having grown up here, I can't imagine what it must have been like to come, you know, be on a plane for the first time, land in New York of all places.
Yeah, yeah. Your parents, what was their family situation in terms of, were they rural people, or did they live in villages? Did they live in small cities?
My mom lived in a town. Well, she didn't live in town, but she lived near the town of Lewisburg, which is not far from Westport, for people who know Mayo. And my dad, it was a little bit more rural. He's about, I think it's about 35 or 40 miles from Galway City. And back then, it was more bustling than it is now, which is to say the houses there were occupied, and there were a couple of families there who had kids, and it just was busier, and there was a school. But then slowly those families left until there were fewer and fewer, which is a lot like what happens to the Cahills area.
Yeah.
Even though that place is a fiction, and Ballyroan is fiction, but I kind of stole from elements from both places.
Yeah. One of the key characters in the novel is Michael Ward, and I mentioned in the introduction that readers meet him in the prologue on the last day of his job working beneath the streets of New York City. His closest friend is a guy named Ned Powers, also Irish. Mm-hmm. How did they become acquainted?
They worked as movers together when Michael first gets to New York. It was his first job. He meets someone on the ship who knows of a job and connects him, which is how this happened for real. That's how everyone got their jobs in the beginning, and he met Ned Powers that way.
Yeah.
Stayed friends.
Would you read an excerpt from that portion of the prologue where Ned says to Michael on his last day, Michael's day, will we go for a pint?
Sure. So this is toward the end of the prologue, and Michael has kind of given up hope that they're going to throw him some kind of party to mark his last day. Will we go for a pint? Powers asked. Powers was 2 years younger than Michael and was the only person, aside from Greta, Michael had known since he first came to New York. They never went for pints after work. They were tired. They were hungry. Greta expected Michael home. He and Powers saw each other often enough outside of work. Powers, who was from Mayo, was first drawn to Michael because he heard he was from Galway. When they first met, Powers had asked Michael what town he was from, what village. He knew every village in Connacht, he claimed, or at least the ones worth mentioning. We moved a lot, Michael had explained, but I liked Greta's place. If we could pick a place to be from, I'd pick there. Moved a lot, Powers had repeated, drawing his eyebrows together. The year was 1963. They were both working as furniture movers, and Michael had not yet considered how he'd answer the question from other Irish. Ned looked at his new acquaintance for so long that Michael scolded himself for not taking Greta's advice, for not just making up a place and sticking to it. And then Powers nodded, a single conclusive dip of the head and thrust of the chin, putting an end to some dialogue he was having inside his own head. An looked shul, Powers had asked. The walking people, travelers, wanderers, tinkers, thieves, An looked shul was a country person's way of putting it. They were all walking people now, Michael had considered pointing out. They were all travelers. Instead, he crossed his arms and waited for whatever Ned would say next. I understand completely, Ned said finally. And then, we're all Americans now anyhow, isn't it true?
Hmm. Mary Beth Keene reading from the prologue of her book, The Walking People. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, tell us about the Travelers. Who are they?
The Travelers are an ethnic group inside Ireland who are considered in many ways a race apart and distinct from Irish who are settled. And they were always interesting to me as a group because they were beyond classification, especially to a young person who wants to know who these people are. When I was, you know, in the 80s, you could still see travelers in camps by the side of the road, usually tented. The barrel top wagons that appear in the book are not something I ever saw in person. I saw them in pictures and heard about them in stories. But I saw tented communities of travelers. And you grow up in New York, you know what it means to be homeless pretty early. But they are not homeless. This is a choice that they make, a way of life that is completely different. And they're marginalized still by many in the Irish community. A lot of people classify them with gypsies from the European continent, but they're considered actually to be a separate group from gypsies. So they're an interesting group of people.
Yeah. So in the 80s, you could still see them in camps in Ireland. 20, 30 years now later, what's the story?
They're settled mostly. There have been, and it starts, there are references to it in the book from the 60s. The government started a push to put them in settled communities and apartments or flats, as they'd call it, or settle them in these townhomes that were built on the outskirts of different places. They have them in Dublin, and Ennis was a big place in the 60s. And there was a lot of resistance to that. And, of course, there's a lot of discrimination that goes with that. And were travelers able to get the kind of schooling that they needed and what sort of schooling was available to them if they were traveling from place to place? And there was resistance on the traveler side to schooling because they didn't want their children to learn that there was anything wrong or bad about their way of life, which was taught in schools. So there's still a lot of tension between travelers and settled Irish people, and Ireland's gotten better, but there's still a ways to go.
Have the travelers contributed to the Irish culture?
Oh, for sure they have. There are, gosh, I wish I could name people specifically, but I know that in music there have been people who've made it and become famous and well-known for different things that are happen to be travelers. And that detail in some cases, I think, gets a little bit lost, you know, the better known they get.
Mm-hmm.
But they have. There were also travelers who came to North Carolina back around the famine years that settled there, and they still speak the language the same as the travelers in Ireland do now, which is separate from Irish and English.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah.
We haven't heard much about these people. This is all news to me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, why choose this kind of life? What was it like that was good enough to you'd stick with it?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's the mystery, and I think that's the reason for a lot of the discrimination. It's something that people just don't understand, and we always, you know, I guess we always fear the things we don't understand, and it's a choice, and I've read a lot about them and read some first-person accounts from people who claim that this is just the way they are. You know, it's in the blood. They want to move and travel and not be settled. And to be settled is to somehow, to give something up of your country and your home and of your life. And it's not a question of money, which I think is the most interesting part. And especially in the 60s and 70s, some of the travelers were much better off than people who were settled. And so it's something entire. It's just a way of life, a choice that is difficult to understand if you're not in it.
Yeah. Well, now let's talk a little bit more about Michael Ward. Why does he choose to leave it and, as they say, settle?
Well, I think Michael Ward was kind of my I wondered what would happen if someone wanted to leave. Everything I'd read claimed that no one ever wanted to leave, or if they did, they came back, and because it was that much better than living in a settled home. And I just thought, well, what happens if there really is someone who leaves and just really wants to be in one place and set down roots? And so I had Michael really yearn to be away from this life and have a home and a wife and children and a job that stays put. And then, of course, ironically, he kind of makes the biggest leap of all after that and leaves Ireland entirely.
Yeah.
But I thought, surely somebody has to think there's another way. It's a difficult community to get access to, and so there is not a lot to read about them and their point of view, because they are very insular, and a lot of people who've tried to research and talk to them and sort of understand this way of life have, it's taken many, many months, even, you know, longer than that, to be immersed and be trusted to get information and get access to their language and, you know, opinions and things like that. So a lot of it is speculation.
Michael in New York, after the furniture moving gig, becomes a sand hog. What's a sand hog?
A sand hog is a person who works underground. And they say anything deeper than a grave, a sand hog built it or excavated it. And sometimes they're known as urban miners. They are the men who, and they're predominantly, I don't think there are any women at this point, they built the foundations for our deepest or our highest buildings that need the deepest foundations, our bridges. In New York, they've been working on water tunnel number 3 since 1970, and that's to replace the first 2 water tunnels that provide all the water to New York. They were built just at the first part of the 20th century, I think 1915 and 1930-something, and they're in dire need of repair, and so number 3 has been a project that's been going on since 1970. And the work, the construction, is anywhere from 400 to 800 feet underground, which is, to give you some perspective, a subway in New York runs maybe 50 feet underground.
Mm-hmm.
So this would be more than 10 times deeper than that. And that's where they do all their work, and they're digging and they're excavating. And it's a huge project. The tunnel will be 60 miles long when it's done, and cost, I believe, $6 billion in total.
Wow. When will it be done?
Their projected finish is 2020.
Mm.
So let's hope that happens.
A lot of sand yet to go.
Yeah.
You've been down in the tunnel. What's it like?
It's scary, just like I expected it to be. It's my father was a sand hog for 31 years, so he still knew people who work on the tunnel. So I said, I'm working on this, and I'd like to go down, and he was good enough to ask them to let me down, which normally I think is a lot harder than I had it. Mm-hmm. So I had some ideas. I'd looked at a lot of pictures. I'd heard stories about work, but it kind of coalesced when I went down there and saw it. It's dark. It's very wet. It's sort of like it's a permanent state of drizzle down there. I stayed mostly in the shaft area. I didn't wander too far. So there's an enormous crane that lowers you down in a metal cage. I think at the point we were at, we went down maybe 600 feet. And then I didn't go all the way down the tunnel. They go to the end of the tunnel in a very small car, almost like a train car without a roof. And I didn't go all the way down, but I walked a bit down and kind of got a sense of how the tunnel narrows and, you know, what it might be like in the small areas. Near the shaft, there's a little bit more space because you have all of the space over your head, and that's where all the machinery is, so they need a little bit more room. It's also very loud. I wasn't expecting that. They went on break shortly after we got down there, so the silence then in comparison to the loudness that was there when the cage touched down was sort of remarkable.
Yeah.
So
Michael Ward realizes this is an important job that he's doing, but yet it's physically and emotionally draining. How did your dad feel about it?
He didn't feel as conflicted about it as Michael Ward. He liked it. He thought it's a good job. He was happy to have it. He liked the men he worked with. There is a brotherhood among the Sandhogs that I sort of learned about more as I was writing about this. I kind of had only seen the side of a Sandhog's life at home. If you're on the graveyard shift, for example, which my dad was for many years, what it's like for the rest of the family. And I imagined, I guess, that his work life was very sad and dreary and he must be depressed because it's a hard job. But as I get older and I hear him talk about it and the day we went down, I realized that he actually enjoyed it, which is a strange thing maybe to say, but there's definitely a brotherhood. They all know that their job is important and rare and that not a lot of people understand it or even know about it.
Or could do it.
Thing.
Or could do it.
But yeah, or could do it, really. You have to be in good shape and you have to be very careful and you have to watch out for one another. So it's remarkable, even driving through, you know, any part of New York, and he could say, oh, in 1979, we used to enter through a door right there in Central Park, or I once, you know, to any manhole or a place in New York, he'd say, oh, we had an entry there. It's like a secret insider's underground tour to New York City. Mm. So he didn't have the same feelings about it as Michael, who was in a constant state of feeling like he was about to quit.
Maybe you'd read another excerpt here from the prologue to give our listeners a sense of what Michael feels about this job and how taxing it is.
Okay. All right. So I will read. Okay, this is a description of the tunnel from the prologue. The men left their plastic lunch bags and mini coolers on the damp and mold-freckled picnic table that had been lowered into the hole 6 years before. They boarded the mining train, a single car, no doors, no roof, like the ride you might see in the littlest kid's part of an amusement park, that would take them to the dead end 2 miles away. As Michael took his seat, he reminded himself that it was his last trip to the end of the tunnel. It didn't feel like his last time. It felt like every other time, no better, no worse. As the train began to move, he saw that someone had used the chalk meant to mark drilling points to draw a huge yellow sun on a dry section of the rock face. Drawing on the rock was common, and if you picked a good spot, it might last for days before being erased by the constant dripping and the wet air. Farther down the tunnel were more drawings, a shamrock, a flag of the Dominican Republic, a series of stick figures. Strung along the mesh wire that covered the sides of the tunnel was the occasional light bulb. As one bulb flickered and then went out, Michael thought about his first day and how he thought he'd last just a few weeks. The job was in the Bronx then, in Woodlawn. It was good money. He and Greta kept reminding each other at the time, but the money meant far less when he went down the shaft for the first time and realized he'd have to arrive in the dark, work in the dark, eat in the dark, finish his day in the dark, drive home in the dark. And when he arrived home, he was too tired for supper, too tired to talk, too tired to touch Greta for weeks at a time, or even to sense her body curled up against him all night long until the alarm went off again and he discovered her behind him, the small spoon holding the big.
Mm. I love that image, the small spoon holding the big.
Yeah, so Michael's far more conflicted about his work than my dad was. And Michael also, I wanted the juxtaposition of his life in Ireland to his life in America. I imagined him in Ireland in big open spaces that were all his, and now it's the total opposite when he gets to the U.S.
Yeah.
So.
Well, tell us about Michael's small spoon, Greta.
Yeah.
In Ballyroan, she is known as Greta the Goose.
Yeah.
Tell us about her. What would you like to tell us about Greta?
Greta is, I feel the star of this story, and she was where I began to think about all of this. And she is the person many families have, especially maybe large Catholic families, that everyone has kind of decided about. this is the one that won't wander too far from home. This is what she's capable of, which is not very much. And I wanted her to surprise them and also surprise herself. Once she takes herself out of a familiar situation, she thrives. And that was something I really, that was sort of the linchpin of all of this, Greta's story. And I don't want to give anything away plot-wise, but she, the reasons that people thought she was not very bright, I mean, these are common stories that are kind of shocking about different things that might be wrong with people or help they might have gotten had they been in a different place at a different time. And so Greta really is the heart of this book.
Yeah. And also, she, one of her brothers, Little Tom, also has some difficulties that, given another place, another time, some more resources, his life would have been quite different.
Totally different. Yeah, but this happens a lot, and it's that someone who has a physical or a mental handicap, well, it's not really a handicap, I suppose, but it's they're kept close to home, and there's just an assumption from day one that, you know, you're not going to do what your brother ends up doing because of X, Y, and Z. And Little Tom, of course, is quite smart, and he's the best writer of the group, and he can communicate perfectly well when he needs to, and does all right in the end. But
very sharp.
Another thing. Yeah.
Very sharp guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer Mary Beth Keene. We're talking with her this afternoon about her debut novel, The Walking People. It's a story of Irish immigration in the latter half of the 20th century. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Perhaps you have a story you could tell us. Are you an immigrant or the child of an immigrant? Are there stories in your family about emigrating from a faraway land? Join us with questions, comments in the Champaign-Urbana area. The number to join in, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, Greta and Little Tom's parents are Lily and Tom Big Tom Cahill. What was the family's circumstances in Ireland?
They had survived for many generations by poaching salmon from the river that ran through their back field. And in the 60s, there was a crackdown on poaching. And this is small time. They would poach and sell what they caught in town to neighbors, to a few inns, you know, further up the road, and that's how they were able to stay and also feed themselves. That's how they were able to stay when everyone else had to leave, you know, bit by bit, because they just couldn't provide, and this was how they provided.
Yeah.
So
it's sad and comic at the same time.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how they try to keep what they're doing secret.
Well, I mean, it's difficult when you have...
Fish?
Well, yeah, fish, exactly, everywhere. And they would, Lily, Big Tom's wife, the mother of Greta, would be in charge of cleaning the fish with the girls and smoking it or curing it and storing it, which they would have to store all over the place. And, of course, the panic would always come over the house if anybody was spotted approaching the cottage from the coast road, which I imagine they could see from certain windows. There was always a lookout. And you'd have to kind of clean up real fast, but how do you get the fish out of a home? And there, you know, there's a certain wink-wink quality to this, which was something I picked up about stories about poaching salmon from both my mother's place and my father's place or any other sort of activity like this. If someone made poutine and sold it out of their home, of course everybody knew, including, you know, law enforcement, whatever that might be. And it was the nature of the time for people to either, you know, look the other way or not. So some of the tension in the book occurs because the person who owns those river rights lives about a mile up the road from the Cahills, and he's frustrated because he knows very well what they're doing, and he knows that everyone else knows, and nobody's doing anything about it. And so he goes out and gets his own people to patrol the riverbanks at night and put a stop to it.
This prohibition seems unfair.
It does, and that's basically what made me so interested in it. During the famine and afterwards, there are different waves of immigration. In my father's place, a lot of what I kind of gathered is that one of the reasons they survived where they were was because they were near water, and they could take whatever fish they could get and at least have something, some kind of sustenance. But when I found out that there were people who owned those rights who might live, in this case, the person who owns them, Mr. Grady, lives a mile up the road, but in some cases they might live 40 miles away. And that person could be in charge of you, you know, being allowed to walk 60 feet up your own yard to a river.
Mm-hmm.
It's very shocking. And I, as a young, you know, spoiled American, I'm sure, to learn this just seemed completely unacceptable. And I remember asking a zillion questions about it when I was a teenager, and I just couldn't stop harping on it, you know, apparently until I wrote a book that included this. I mean, now the struggle is a little bit different, and conservationists are trying to keep people from poaching in a bigger way, which is right, it seems to me.
Yeah.
The country's doing a lot better. But then, you know, people, plain and simple, in the 50s and 60s were hungry, and that you couldn't feed your family. I don't know, it was just shocking. And that you felt you had a right to it. Your land, you've been there for, let's say, 8 generations, and the river that you walk through, wade through to your other field every day is not yours. It's hard to understand, at least from my perspective, a suburbanite.
Yeah.
And so that was something that was really interesting to me.
Yeah. What was the pattern of emigration in the latter half of the 20th century? I think as Americans, even Irish Americans, we think of the famine as a great period of emigration. But what was going on in the 50s and 60s, and how did that affect the folks who were left in Ireland, a person like Lily?
Yeah, no one ever talks really too much about the people who were left behind. There was a wave in the 20s, and then there was another wave in the late 50s, early 60s, through the end of the 60s, and it's, again, an economic crisis. There just weren't enough jobs, and so the country kind of emptied out. I mean, I researched this in as far as I needed it. I knew anecdotal evidence from my family. They all came in the early 60s, early to mid-60s, and so did the parents of many of my friends. And so then I looked to see, was this true across the board? And it was. And, you know, it was a scarcity of jobs primarily, and that was it. A lot of people went to London or to different parts of England so they could kind of come back and forth, but some people went a lot further. But it was definitely another wave that doesn't get written about all that much. It was difficult to find stories or accounts of what it was like, because I really didn't want to stick to what my parents had gone through. I wanted to make it a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
But there was one project out of the University College Cork it's called the Center for Migration Studies, and they're doing a Breaking the Silence project, and there are a lot of first-person accounts from people who either left for a year or two or were left behind. And it's really, I had a little correspondence with them, and they also found a real lack of literature about the immigration or migration in this period.
Boy, it sounds like there's a great oral history project.
Yeah.
Before it's too late.
Yeah.
You know, in recent years, we've seen Ireland is just booming. And it's hard to think that 50 years ago, a lot of the countryside didn't have electricity.
Yeah. Real late. It came to some places even later than 1962. for some. There's this very small island that I don't even, it's not even named, very near my father's place. They didn't have electricity until later than that. It is remarkable.
Yeah.
And again, it comes back to that idea of how people get from A to B. I mean, this is not just an Irish story. This is an immigration story. Think about where, when you hear an accent, or when I hear an accent, I think, where did this person begin?
Mm-hmm.
And now you are here. Like, it's amazing. Could you have fathomed this when you were a kid or a teen, wherever you were from? It's a difficult thing.
Yeah. I found myself wondering, you know, how many men working beneath the streets of New York City on this tunnel project are immigrants?
I'm not sure about that. That's a good question. I know that it's a multi-generation job. So you have, you know, I'm sure in many families it started out as a job that somebody came when they got here.
Mm-hmm.
But you meet a lot of people whose fathers and even at this point grandfathers were sandhogs. So I think it's probably something maybe recent.
Mm-hmm.
Immigrants do, and people who are not Mayflower families necessarily. but there are a lot of American accents down there, but people who identify Irish or what, you know, wherever else they're from, there are a lot of Irish as sandhogs.
Yeah. So give us some perspective. You're first generation. Give us some perspective of what life is like for first generation Irish Americans.
It's a lot like Ireland in the 60s, I think, growing up. It's something I've talked about with my Irish cousins. My mom has eight sisters, and half of them stayed in Ireland, half of them came here. And why the Americans had, or as they call us, the Americans, turned out to be in some ways more Irish than the Irish who stayed. And I think it's because when you come over here for reasons that are not quite by choice, you know, out of need, and you never really, if there had been jobs there, I'm sure both my parents would have stayed happily. But when you leave because you have to, I think you preserve home in a way that maybe they didn't do over there because they were there. You know, why talk about Ireland all the time or the way we do things or the way it was then when it's all around you? But here, it was a constant thing. And so in some ways, I think the way I grew up was like Ireland in the 60s inside my house, whereas my cousins in Ireland, you know, they moved on just like the country moved on. It's hard to explain, but there is a certain amount of preservation that I think is probably true for a lot of first-generation kids.
Yeah, there are a number of really wonderful memoirs out recently of first-generation Asian Americans,
mm-hmm.
and I've talked with a couple of women who have written these memoirs, and that is it seems to be the universal experience that the generation that leaves their home country comes to the United States and sets up their home, there's that word again, in the U.S. to be a safe haven.
Yeah, that's true. I'm sure that's true across the board. And as your home country grows up and modernizes, you don't quite do that alongside your home country, which is also adds another layer, because when we go back, or my parents would go back, sometimes there was an element of sort of surprise or alienation because the Ireland they remembered and that they taught us didn't really exist anymore. And so that was disorienting to us, too, as kids, when I saw, you know, Ireland has everything. Maybe not in the 80s, but certainly in the 90s and after 2000. And so the stories I'd heard and been taught didn't quite line up with what I was seeing and all the modern amenities and all that. So, and now, of course, Ireland is suffering worse than the U.S. in terms of the economy. So the boom has
popped.
I think, popped badly. So,
Greta's the star of the story in The Walking People. And I think before we wrap up, we should spend a little bit more time talking with her. She's a character who, had things been better and had circumstances not been what they were, she would have stayed in Ireland.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how she fares, without telling us too much, and her thoughts of home, meaning Ireland.
She fares much better than anyone expected her to. And when she left home and got away from those expectations or lack of expectations that people had, she was able to get a little bit more courageous, I think of it, a little bit more independent. And she started realizing that she could accomplish things that she previously might have thought she couldn't. Her thoughts of home are different, or at least I see it that way. They're different than some other immigrants. She misses home, and she has a strong tie to home, especially when her mother is still alive. But she's pretty clear about what the U.S. and what America has given her. And unlike a lot of people who talk about going home, you know, for the 40 years they're in the U.S., they're on the verge of going home and building a house and moving back. Greta has none of those ideas. She knows the U.S. has been good to her, and she wants to stay. And that was a deliberate choice on my part. I've read a lot of immigration stories that end by with the characters going home, and it's this big sentimental return. And I wanted that to not be the case with these characters, with the Cahills and the Wards, and for them to realize that they have it good here. And sure, they may have made it at home in a different way, but they made it here, and they built their life here and made their family here, and they're Americans now in many ways. Without giving up entirely their Irish identity, they're here for good, and that's okay.
How did this novel is really so beautifully written, Mary Beth.
Thanks.
How did it progress? And maybe you could talk with us just a little bit, we don't have much time left here, about how you did it.
Piecemeal, I think, is probably the most accurate. I started it actually with Greta's point of view in the first person. I got about 150 pages, and I realized I wanted to hear more voices in this world. And so I threw out what I had, and I started over and started third person, multiple point of view, with Greta still as the heart of the book. It's difficult when someone is not, Greta is very bright, but maybe not as articulate about how she feels or how she is or what she wants as another person might be. And so I needed other people's perspective to kind of round out who Greta was and give a full picture. I don't know. I didn't write it in order, and I wanted to really just show a life from beginning, or sort of the beginning, to, you know, one of the final chapters. I mean, she's still young, but you kind of get a sense of what her trajectory is at the end of the novel. And I didn't mean for it to be any sort of epic. I just kind of wanted to juxtapose different key moments in her life and put it together as a full picture, and hopefully make it feel full and real.
I imagine you had a really good time, or really found it rewarding creating the characters.
I did. I mean, I was sometimes, of course, I felt I was over my head, and sometimes I felt like I didn't do them justice in different parts, and some parts were much more difficult than others. I really enjoyed writing the letters, because it gave me a chance to do that first person point of view that I'd thrown out, and to be Greta in the eye was the most fun of all the different parts. But I really tried to be on guard against any sort of sentimentality, or I think things were difficult enough, and I wanted to be frank and straightforward about the different things that happened to them without kind of polishing them with any kind of high sheen or look at me language.
Yeah, sentimentality.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and I think we Irish have a tendency toward that anyway, so we have to be, I had to police myself. But I really am very fond of Greta in a way that I had never experienced in any of my short stories, maybe because it's a longer period of time you spend together.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this was quite an experience.
Well, thank you for writing it, and thank you for talking with me this afternoon, and I look forward to the next novel.
Well, me too.
Okay.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure, and I look forward to talking with you in the future.
Okay.
When the next project is finished.
Okay, me
All right.
too.
Okay, take care. Mary Beth Keene has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of The Walking People. It's a story of Irish immigration in the latter half of the 20th century. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You've been listening to an interview from the AM 580 archives. You'll find interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and Focus 580 on our website. Visit WILL.UIUC.EDU.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com. Support for Illinois Public Media comes from Syngenta, featuring AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids, designed to give you up to 38 bushels more per acre if you have rootworms, and an average of 3 more even if you don't. More information on Syngenta's AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids is at agrisuretraits.com.
I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois. Time now to check in on what's been happening in the world of agricultural commodities for the afternoon. Nearby wheat in the soft red contract had a high price today of $4.65 1/4, a low at $4.56 1/4, with a settlement price at $4.57 1/4, finished 4.5 cents lower. The March futures there, $4.85 the high, the low at $4.76, settled $4.76 3/4, down 4 3/4 in the May contract in the wheat pit for the soft red. $4.96 1/2 the high price, the low at $89 1/4, settlement price at $4.89 1/2, down 4 1/2 cents. July futures, that's the harvest month for next year, $5.08 1/2 the top, the bottom at $5.01, settled $5.01 1/2, down 4 1/2. From Kansas City, the hard red winter wheat down 2 1/4 today at $4.72. From the corn pit now, December contract in Chicago, $3.18 was the final price on the day. Settlement price there down 11, the high at $3.29 1/4, the low at $3.16 3/4. The harvest month corn December at $3.18 on its settlement price, once again 11 cents lower. The March futures, $3.42 1/4 the high, the low at $3.30. Settlement price at $3.31 1/2, down 10 3/4. In the May contract, $3.51 3/4 the high, the low at $3.39 1/2, settled $3.40 1/2, down 11 cents. July contract, $3.60 1/4 the high, the low at $4.48 1/4. Settlement price at $3.49, down 11 1/4. In September, corn futures, $3.67 3/4 the high, the low at $3.57. Settlement price at $3.57 1/4, down 11 1/2 cents. December contract for next year, a $3.78 top, bottom at $3.66 1/2, settled $3.67 1/4, down 11 1/2 cents. From the oat pit, nearby December contract, a $2.16 top, bottom at $2.12 1/2, settled $2.13, down a penny. The March $2.28 1/4 the high, the low at $2.25 1/2, settlement price at $2.26, down 1. Soy complex now, November beans, $9.58 the high, the low at $9.36, settlement price at $9.41, down 12 cents. January futures in the bean pit, $9.61 the high, the low at $9.40 3/4 cents, settlement price at $9.45 1/4, down 11. March futures, $9.60 1/2 the high, the low at $42, settlement price at $9.46 1/2, down 9. And the May contract in the bean pit, $9.57 the high, the low at $9.40, settlement price at $9.43 3/4, down 7 3/4. July futures, $9.57 1/4 the high, the low at $41, settlement price at $9.44 1/2, down 7 1/2 cents. And next year's November soybean futures, a 14-cent loss today, $9.21 1/4 the high, the low at $8.98 1/2, a settlement price at $9.04, down $2.14. During the closing market report this afternoon, comes up in just about 10 minutes now, I'll talk with Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics out of Lafayette, Indiana. He'll join us along with Brian Maple, who will help us take up the cash grain market. Bruce Bostrich usually along on a Friday, but Elway this afternoon. So Brian Maple graciously agreeing to set in for him today. That'll all happen in just about 10 minutes now, right here on the closing market report. Here are the numbers from the CME's livestock side, nearby live cattle futures, the October contract today. A high price of 86, a settlement price at 85.55, and a low at 85.45. Once again, the settlement for the October live cattle futures, $85.55, down 22.5. December futures, 85.25, the high price for the day, the low at 84.65, settlement price at 84.90, down 45. And February futures, 86.32.5, the high, the low at 85.65. Settled at 85.72.5, down 82.5. April contract in the live cattle pit, 88.35, the high, the low at 87.92.5, settlement price at $88 even. That finished down 52.5 cents. September feeder cattle on the afternoon, 97.25, the high, the low at 96.65, settlement price at $97.25, 60 cents higher. October futures, 97.10, the high, the low at 96.30, settled at $97.25, up 32.5. And November futures in the feeder cattle pit, 97.45, the high, the low at 96.55, settlement price at 97.42.5, 42.5 cents higher. January futures now, $98.60, the high, the low for the day at 97.65, and a settlement price for the January feeders at 98.55, up 30 cents. Lean hog futures, October contract, $51.80 a hundredweight for the high, the low at 50.50, settled at $50.80, down $1.37.5. December futures, 51.60 the high, the low at $50.02.5, settlement price for the December lean hogs at 50.30, down $1.72.5, and February contract now, 58.25 the high, the low at 56.72.5, settled at 56.92.5, down $1.40. April futures, 63.30 the high, the low at 61.17.5, settled 62.95, 5 cents lower on the afternoon. And the frozen pork bellies for the day. The high price at $85.50 in the February contract, the low at 84.60, settlement price at 84.60. Down $2. That's the limit lower. The March futures, an 83.32.5 settlement price for the pork bellies, and they finish down $1.97.5. I'll have more in just a moment. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like. It's mostly clear skies. Lows will range from 45 in the north away from Lake Michigan to around 60 in the far south tomorrow. In the north and central sections, mostly sunny skies, mostly cloudy with a chance of scattered showers. In the south, highs will range from 75 in northern Indiana to 82 in the south. The extended forecast on Saturday says scattered showers are likely in the southern quad.